Well, if you think that net neutrality, that battle, maybe the battle over privacy on the internet, if you think that's all a product of modern technology, you're partially right, except you have to remember that modern technology applies to all technology, which is new. At some point, it's all modern. So this battle's been going on for a long time, and we can learn something from the way it's worked out in the past. Right now, we have the guru of net neutrality issues with us, Tim Wu. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and author of the new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what you're basically arguing in here, and very persuasively, is that this what we're hearing now is an echo of the battle that we had over, say, the beginning of the telephone, over the development of the radio, the television, and then on to into motion picture films, that every time we get a new method of transmitting information, there's a battle over control.
That's exactly right. Repeatedly, in every new medium, what we see is an early period of openness and in some ways utopianism that later leads to a battle by one, usually one or a few companies that want to close it.
And in your book, you point to certain sort of iconic figures who, I mean, you describe this place in which there's new technology, those innovations, and it breeds a kind of chaos. People are trying to figure out how it works, trying to figure out how they can make it work and make it profitable. And then a sort of mogul appears and takes control.
Yeah, that's right. There's something maybe about information markets that tend to attract a certain kind of figure. We call him the mogul, but everyone calls him the mogul, who has, first of all, has the desire to found a private kingdom, a desire, almost a kind of fetish over the power you have over people's minds in these markets, who also has a vision of turning closing and making this into a much more consolidated industry. And what he typically offers consumers is more reliability and higher quality, and what he typically does to his competitors is take them over or destroy them.
Well, you know, Wired magazine said just famously the other month that the internet was dead because everybody uses somebody's corporate-controlled app. They don't actually exist on the internet in the way that they used to even 10 years ago. I guess I'm wondering, in this mogul question, how is this any different than what John D. Rockefeller did with the railroads and with the distribution of oil and the monopolization of energy commodities?
It's not that different. Many of the techniques used are exactly the same. The railroad, I don't want to go into the full history of Standard Oil, but the Standard Oil's monopoly was premised on the railroad. So
right.
You can see similar. It's very similar to premising your that was their platform in the same way that you think of an operating system being a platform now. So, no, the methods were the same, in fact. Network effects, economies of scale, and promising consumers something.
Well, you in your book, you write, markets are born free, yet no sooner are they born than some would-be emperor is forging change. I found it incredibly interesting that you said George Zucker was called the Napoleon of motion pictures, but what he really wanted to be was the Godfather. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's the history of Hollywood. Hollywood, we think of Hollywood is just being around forever, that in some way it just seems natural that films are made by a few major studios in California. But there was a time where there was hundreds of studios. There was New York industry, there was a San Francisco industry, there was they were all over the country. And it were a few men with imperial ambitions, notably Adolf Zucker, who you just mentioned, who vertically integrated the industry and turn it into just a few studios with a lot more power. And when I say Godfather like control, I mean that they relished the role of being able to pass out favors and be in charge. Often the way they rule these empires is like an emperor, put it that way.
And he actually, you talk about how he kind of modeled his film company on Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, very similar design in the sense that the idea of Ford Motor and companies like Carnegie Steel was they decided to own everything, from the shop floor all the way up to the assembly line. And in film, the idea was you own the actors, you own the writers, you own the cameras, you own all of distribution, and you own the theaters. And then once you've integrated everything together, you can create films like King Kong and so forth. You create an industrial structure for the creation of film. That was the idea of Hollywood. And you see the same thing going on today. I don't know if we go to the today, but when you look at a company like Apple, which is busily putting together cell phones with iTunes, with AT&T, when it's all sort of integrated, they, Steve Jobs is following the playbook of Hollywood very closely.
But he's still a gadget guy. I mean, I'm wondering if Google has signs of this kind of integration in the sense that they're trying to own both the distribution platform and the means for buying and selling ads.
I wouldn't call Steve Jobs a gadget guy. I think he's gone beyond that and into the realm of mogul. He is very. What's unique about Steve Jobs, and I'll get to Google in a second, is that he has a very deep understanding of content, a very close understanding of Hollywood. He's spent time on the board of Hollywood firms, so he understands the strategies of bringing the highest quality content and essentially closing the market in a way that consumers find of attractive. As for Google, Google is the most similar now, I'd say, to AT&T in the 1910s. Powerful monopoly that has promised to do good for the country and therefore is tolerated on the basis of its good behavior.
And yet, in the end, AT&T, you point out, they developed the answering machine long before in the 1930s. We didn't get it till the 1960s because of this monopoly and what they were afraid it would do to their monopoly of the industry.
The thing about monopolies is they tend to be pretty good at the beginning. You know, there's this period where we are with Google right now and maybe with Facebook where they're new and very enthusiastic and just providing all kinds of great stuff. The original founders are still around. The problem becomes it's kind of like congressmen or dictators. When you've been in power for a while and you sort of lose interest in doing new things, become more interested in staying in power. And there's a definite tendency for monopolies, once they've been in power for, say, 10 or 20 years, to start to become stagnant and abusive. So we haven't got there with the Internet yet, but we need to keep our eyes open.
So these guys hate competition just as much as any of the other monopolies, ultimately.
Nobody, I mean, whatever people say, life's a lot easier without competition. Now, I'm not sure if Google hates. I think they, if you ask the leaders of Google, they'd say they love competition. And maybe they do. I mean, they're... Maybe we're a little different now. I'm not sure. I think AT&T truly hated competition. They thought it was immoral. they thought that it brought out the worst in men, and that monopoly was better because if you had all the power, then you behaved more responsibly.
Well, that's not what Tim Wu argues. A professor at Columbia Law School, whose new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Thanks so much, Tim.
It's been a great pleasure.
We've got an assignment for our takeaway listeners, especially those of you who downloaded the free iPhone app at iTunes. You remember potato, or tomato? What about pecan or pecan? The way we pronounce words changing all the time. We're trying to track the evolution of language a little bit. Record yourself or someone you know saying a word that you think sounds different or is changing. If you don't have the Takeaway app, you can call or submit your suggestions on the website, thetakeaway.org, or call 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.